You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 26th of January 2015 on Monocle 24.
Coming to you live from Studio One, this is Midori House. Welcome to the programme. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show,
I am Kenji Goto Jogo. You have seen the photo of my cellmate Haruna slaughtered in the land of the Islamic Caliphate. You were warned. You were given a deadline, and so my captives acted upon their words.
That was the voice of Japanese journalist Kenji Goto speaking after the apparent death of his friend, fellow captive Haruna Yukawa. The group is now offering to release Mr. Goto if a well-known terrorist in Jordan is handed over. But could this be even more unrealistic than the earlier demand for $200 million in ransom? For insight on that, I'm joined in the studio by James Hoare and Tim Marshall. Also coming up,
I'm honored to be the first American president to attend this celebration, as well as the first president to visit India twice. This reflects my commitment since the beginning of my presidency to deepen our ties with India.
Geopolitical metaphors and diplomatic gestures. US President Barack Obama's visit to India has many speculating what it might mean for future ties between the nations. So, how significant is this display of importance for India on the world stage? And a little later in the programme, we'll hear about a newly reopened museum in Beirut that's set to reinvigorate the city's arts culture. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So lots to come in the next hour here on Midori House, but before any of that, here's James Luckhurst with the latest news.
Monocle 24 News. The Greek left-wing leader Alexis Tsipras has been sworn in as the prime minister of a new hardline anti-bailout government, determined to face down international lenders and end nearly 5 years of tough economic measures. The decisive victory by Tsipras's Syriza in Sunday's snap election reignites fears of new financial troubles in the country that set off the regional crisis in 2009. It's also the first time a member of the 19-nation Eurozone will be led by parties rejecting German-backed austerity. DZ Bank head of research Stefan Bielmeier says he doesn't expect a big impact on the euro area.
Well, actually, definitely the result wasn't unexpected, and I think for the rest of the euro area so far it will have any strong implications, as now the negotiations with the eurozone, with the troika, will start between the new Greek government and the European institutions. So this will take a very long time in my view. We will need until summer to reach here some results. So in the end, I do not expect strong effects for the euro area in the very near future.
Kurdish forces say they've driven Islamic State militants from Kobane, ending a four-month battle for the northern Syrian town. Fighters from the popular protection units were said to have entered outlying areas in the east of the town after the jihadists retreated. There were reports of people dancing in the streets and of celebratory gunfire. Analysts say the battle for Kobane has been seen as a major test of the US-led coalition strategy to combat IS with airstrikes. 10 people have been killed and another 13 injured after a Greek fighter plane crashed during NATO training in Spain today. A spokesman for the Defense Ministry said the F-16 plane crashed shortly after taking off at the training center in Albacete, 262 kilometers southeast of the capital, Madrid. The United Nations has opened a second round of political talks over Libya in Geneva and played down the absence of a key faction, saying only the site of the talks was a point of contention. 4 years after Muammar Gaddafi's fall, Libya has two rival governments, one internationally recognized and the other set up by a faction that has taken over Tripoli, who are locked in a conflict Western powers fear will slide into civil war. Mohamed Shoaib, first vice president of the Libyan parliament, called for pressure to be put on all fanatical groups.
All the international community, the Security Council, for example, we have a resolution 2574, and it's talking about sanctions. Maybe this is the right moment to impose some sort of sanction against those who refuse to join the peaceful process.
America's National Weather Service has warned a potentially historic blizzard could dump up to 90 centimeters of snow on the U.S. northeast coast. New York's mayor said the storm could be the city's biggest ever, telling residents to prepare for the worst. Heavy snowfall is forecast from Philadelphia to Maine. More than 3,000 flights have already been cancelled, and judges in Boston say two high-profile criminal trials in Massachusetts will be delayed. The trials involve the accused Boston Marathon bomber and a former New England Patriots player charged with murdering an associate. But people elsewhere in New England don't seem to be bothered by the storm warnings.
I'm ready. Bring it on. I enjoy it. You know, I used to live in Tampa Bay, so this is a nice street. And it is New England. It is winter.
No problem for me. It's not even one lecture, so got to come. So got to do what you have to do.
And those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Buenos Aires
to Toronto
to Amsterdam,
all around the world, this is Monocle 24.
Well, you're listening to Midori House, and the time here in London is 18:06, which means it's 13:06 in New York. And joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is academic and former diplomat James Hoare and diplomatic editor for Sky News, Tim Marshall. Welcome, gentlemen, to the show. Well, we're going to start in Japan, where news that one of the hostages being held by ISIS was killed over the weekend has now been confirmed. A video has been posted on Twitter accounts affiliated with the Islamic State militants, showing Japanese journalist Kenji Goto holding a photo of what appears to be the body of his fellow captive, Haruna Yukawa. Tim, I'll start with you. We were discussing this last week and the tricky role that Shinzo Abe, the Prime Minister, is having to play at the moment. He wants to be involved on the world stage. He feels it is time for Japan to kind of break out of its island mentality. And here he is when they're trying to deal with something which, you know, it's not his fault that these people went to the region, but he's certainly having to deal with the consequences. And one of the consequences is that he's being attacked for even giving aid to the surrounding states. But do you feel that there was anything that he could have done over the past few days to have changed this narrative?
Hand over $200 million, which, of course, he couldn't do and didn't do. And the consequence of flowed from that. The responsibility lies with those that murdered the Japanese security man aid worker, but apparently appears to be a bit of a fantasist. But you know, that's not an excuse for murdering him. So that's all he could have done. But he couldn't do it. So what can he now do? There is a slight chance, very, very slight, to save the life of the Japanese journalist. And that is because it's no longer $100 million for him. Now it's to release the female would-be suicide bomber that is in a Jordanian jail. If the Japanese can very quietly, and they have their deputy foreign minister in Amman, if very quietly they can say, look, do you think you could do this? Do you think you could let her go? Think you could do the swap. We can't do it, but you could do it. And then down the line, you might find that we're very good friends with you. That would be a face-saving way out for Japan to get their guy out. But as I said, that is just a very, very slim chance, and it's not something that I would be pinning any hopes on.
James, it's always really hard to kind of to fathom what's going on in the minds of IS. But I wanted to ask you a question, which it seems very strange to drop your demands from $200 million to the release of one single prisoner. Do you feel that potentially IS are beginning to realise that this, if they were trying to negotiate anything, they're not very good at it and it doesn't come out very well in the end, that potentially they're trying to lower the stakes themselves to see if they can get some success to claim that, you know, these beheadings actually do end up in results that benefit them?
I've never met any negotiator who thought he wasn't good at the job, he or she wasn't good at the job. I suspect it's more that that they may feel that they're not going to get money, but they might get a person. There are precedents in the Israeli negotiations.
It's easier done, isn't it?
It is easier done, if you can persuade the person who's holding the prisoner to let them go. But I don't really think that the Japanese can be certain that any trade would actually work, and that the negotiations might go ahead. there might be an agreement to release the prisoner, but you can never be sure at the end that ISIS isn't going to kill the other journalist. They don't seem to care that the international opprobrium that comes with these actions at all.
Tim, can I ask you, interesting, just before we came on the show, I was looking at all the news websites. This story is actually very, very low down. And I wonder if that's a kind of, you know, not a kind of, you know, being instructed by governments or anything, but in the mind of journalists where they're thinking, one, we're a little fatigued by these stories, they're not very successful, but to a sense that, you know, it's actually, it's this is what they love. This is us talking about them. Do you feel that there's a sense that people are feeling a little bit queasy about giving the publicity that IS are demanding in a way?
I think there's all that going on. Firstly, there is the fact that the Japanese media, of course, it's a big story for them, but it's not as big as it might be in other countries. And that's because there is limited, there's a lot of sympathy, but limited, I don't know what the word is, compassion, no, it's not the word, but there's limited
empathy.
Empathy. They're not really going for this story. So that's the first thing. The second thing in the worldwide media is, as you know, a story is if a man bites a dog, not if a dog bites a man. And we have now, I wouldn't say got used to it, but it is not, it doesn't have the impact it did. You know, we know now what happens. It has happened over and over again. And it's going to continue to happen. Therefore, it becomes slightly less newsworthy. But I think that third element you mentioned is also in there. And I noticed that quite a lot of people in the Western media, I don't know about elsewhere, when the remaining hostage was forced to hold up the picture, a lot of things were blanked out by Western media, saying we're not going to give them the satisfaction of showing any of this. And that was an interesting move. And I think there is something that we are now thinking, we don't want to give them that oxygen of publicity. But at the same time, you do have a duty as news journalists to say stuff is happening. So all that's gone. And it's like, do you remember one time when, I don't know, Iraq was the most important story in the world, dominating 24/7, month after month, and then it falls off? You can't keep covering the same things all the time.
You know, I wonder whether you get briefings at Sky or James, whether what your feeling was. What was strange was these two Japanese people were suddenly, you know, came to the fore. I hadn't seen any discussion in the media before that. So there'd obviously been some sense of that being kept quiet. Do you think that, when if this gentleman is either released or he is beheaded and that is the end of that story, that they're going to pull out, you know, two French people, two Italian people.
Oh, yes.
Are governments keeping quiet about how many people are currently being held by IS, do you think?
I think it's probably not quite as simple as that. It's often that, you know, I don't know when the kidnapping took place, but the stories come... There are other stories, there's competition, until something happens.
Yeah, but there must have been two mothers who knew that their sons were missing. But, and what's strange is it doesn't get on the agenda until...
But this story has not gone down in Japan with a great deal of, we must do help our guys.
But you're right, they weren't told. The Japanese people weren't told, and there was an agreement between the Japanese government and the British government. Excuse me.
We're not responsible for this.
But the British government does this as well quite a lot when there are British people. The Foreign Office usually takes a view, we think it's better not to have any publicity. That's what they advise the family. 9 times out of 10, the family says, we'll take your advice. We've never been in this situation before. Sometimes down the line, they get fed up with that, and then they come to the media and say, we do want the publicity. But usually the media will say, okay, if it's your considered advice that if we put their names out there, we're going to make things worse for them and get them killed, we will talk to you about this. And it's happened at the moment with an American woman. I mean, very few people know there is an American woman who is being held by ISIS, probably in Syria. And the only reason I'm saying that is that inadvertently a White House spokesman blurted out her first name into a microphone by accident over the weekend. Now, a lot of people knew she was being held, but it was only at that point that he came out with her first name, and the American media are cooperating and saying, no, we're not going to put this family through it, and we're not going to give them the publicity yet. But, you know, we live in a free democracy. We do reserve the right at some point to say, if you're going to cover it, we're going to cover it.
There's always the hope that behind-the-scenes negotiations, if you don't have too much publicity, might be successful. I mean, The chances are not very great, but there is always the hope.
Well, tell that to John McCarthy, who had four years.
It's just interesting to see where the balance of who's running that story comes from. As you say, it is great in a way that the White House is trying to control it until someone blurts it out. But in a way, you just don't know who's best to control the story. But we need to move on. And the other story, which has been everywhere today, which is the swearing in of the new prime minister for Greece. History was made in Greece at the weekend as the country voted in its first ever leftist prime minister. But while his anti-austerity message proved popular with fed-up voters, international observers have been somewhat doubtful over how Alexis Tsipras will handle the dark clouds of debt that still linger over his country. Tim, a gentleman turns up like us today without a tie. Could be a tiny thing. When we do this thing in the magazine, which is called Style Leader, which tries to detect something about how people present themselves, about how they think. But it felt like away with the old. No tie. I'm not going to have any kind of.
That's what he was doing. That's exactly what he was doing.
Cameron doesn't wear a tie on certain occasions.
On the swearing
but
in.
But looks super uncomfortable when he's not wearing a tie. He's not very good in that.
He doesn't go to the
look.
Mansion House speech without wearing a white tie, as it happens. Yeah, it is a white tie for that one. That's exactly what he was doing. He was saying this is a new time, and it really is a new time, because the first time since the generals were finally thrown out and it became a democracy again in the mid-70s, the two parties, which in American terms would be Republican and Democrat, the mainstream parties, are nowhere near power. And in fact, this revolutionary leftist party is getting into bed with one that got 4.7 to make the coalition. And they mean revolutionary times. I'm very sceptical if they have the clout to go and pin Angela Merkel against the wall and say, right, we're going to negotiate how much money you're going to give us. It's a tough sell, that.
James, there's lots of intriguing things about it. But what was interesting was to watch the markets. They seemed completely unfazed by it. Maybe they've already built in what their reaction was going to be. But do you think that actually there's a sense that, there's a lot of, rhetoric in the run-up, you must not elect this man from outsiders, but actually now he's in power, some kind of deal will be done?
I suspect it's something like that. That, leading into an election, there's a lot of hot air. And a lot of hype goes on. Once somebody is in power or on the edge of power, then they have to compromise and other people have to learn to live with this new development. And I suspect that it's far too early to say what the consequences for Greece is going to be or for the Greek economy. I agree that it's unlikely the new prime minister is going to be able to stand up to the Germans and say, now you pay us for all the things you've done in the past. Yeah. Although that is a theme that comes across in Greece. But, the next couple of weeks are going to see a lot of negotiations behind the scenes. You'll also start seeing a lot of leaks and things and so on as these negotiations take place. Because for the EU, this is a threat. It's a major threat. It's not just Greece. It's what other countries might do as well. If Greece comes out of the Eurozone and then out of the EU, both of which have been suggested, then other countries might well think, well, we'll go back to our Spanish peseta.
Well, that's why they're blackmailing.
Well, yes, but it's also what else can they do? That's the only negotiation.
Keep taking the medicines. The right of centre would say, keep taking the medicine. It is a giant game of bluff, Andrew, a huge, massive game of bluff, and it comes down to me, as far as I'm concerned, to a question: will the Eurozone sacrifice Greece and allow it to fall out of the Eurozone in order to save the euro? Because by putting a bullet in Greece's head, or it's putting it in its own head, they can say to everyone else, you see, you can't get away with not going by the rules of the bailouts, and therefore everybody else will stick by the rules. Or is it the other way round, that Greece is holding a gun to its own head and saying, look how crazy we are, we're going to blow our own heads off unless you give us more money, and the Eurozone says, we don't want to take the risk of them falling out in case other people panic and fall out. And no one knows which of those two things it's going to be.
And it's fascinating to think, they've done this partnership with a populist right-wing party, but that populist right-wing party still believes in being part of Europe, being part of the euro. They don't have a kind of like a Nigel Farage of Greece saying, let's go back to the drachma, let's kind of pull ourselves out, we should be better off on our own. It feels that everybody still feels invested in the project of being in Europe, James.
I think that's right, that... The you know, the new government has to make a stand. But the real negotiations start tomorrow, perhaps. Yeah. And the real negotiations may take them far away from where they've made their stand up till now. And that the stand was to get into power, to challenge the austerity measures. But once you're faced with the reality of actually running a country, in so many cases, you have to compromise. And all government of any sort is a form of compromise, what you can do and what you can't do. And
there are things that, for example, their new plan needs $13.5 billion. That's going to get them through the next few months. And the EU will probably, the Eurozone will probably say, okay, we will give you that as long as you promise this. And they can also say, we'll let you go to the markets to borrow money, and we'll get it at a decent percentage rate for you to borrow, and they'll give them some time. But they will not, the German electorate will not allow Angela Merkel to say to them, yes, you can have lots and lots of money, and you can employ lots and lots of people, and you can have as much healthcare, and you can all retire at 55, and you can have your 13-month pension payment, which he wants to reintroduce, all that stuff. There's going to have to be some give by this new Greek government, because if there isn't, I do think that the EU, the Eurozone, might call their bluff.
Because I think the other interesting thing, you know, he, in his victory speech, Tsipras was saying that, you know, he felt that this was, you know, a battle for all Europeans, and, you know, he was representing all the kind of European people who are being put down by. But the trouble is that PR story doesn't work back in Germany, does it? You know, because even though if you sat down and explained for a long time that actually some German voters might be better off if some of the debt was written off, that isn't how it plays outside of Greece. And I think, you know, that, James, do you think that he has any hope of persuading ordinary voters in Germany and the UK to say, actually, we'll continue to give you additional money even if you go your own way?
I think you wouldn't worry too much about ordinary voters at this stage. It's governments you have to deal with. And governments, even tough governments like the German government, may compromise for the bigger
the greater gains. Good.
The greater good, well.
And let's just return before we move on, just finally to that, you know, the symbolism, you know, decoding his actions today. James, do you think it's significant that his casual style, his, you know, no tie, it's like he's kind of ready for business, that, you know, the refusal to be, you know, dobbed in by the priests, as it were, his manner seems to be perhaps almost right for the time. I wonder if it's that almost that got him the votes, in a way, that he just, there's something, he's got that little bit of charisma you need to persuade people.
I'm sure that's it, that most politicians don't have much charisma. When one comes along that has a new style, and often when you start, at least, style is everything. Think of Mr. Blair. And substance is another matter, and that takes time to develop, particularly if you're completely new to government.
Well, bad news for the tie makers of Athens, but we'll see whether it's good news for the people of Greece. We're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, James Hoare and Tim Marshall. When we return, we'll discuss the political ripples of US President Barack Obama's visit to India.
As the day draws down in Europe and the next morning begins in Asia, the Monocle Daily is on hand to bring you up to speed with a one-hour programme packed with news, business and the best culture and design stories from around the world. Our presenting team in London are joined by guests in Monocle's New York and Toronto studios.
There's lots that the US and the international community can do, but it's enfeebled by its diplomatic and political shortcomings.
And as the sun rises from Tokyo to Sydney, we'll take a look at some of the more interesting front pages landing on doorsteps across the region.
The authority of the Chinese Communist Party has been challenged on its doorstep in Hong Kong, and they do not like it.
That's the Monocle Daily, every weekday at 2200 hours London time, in association with UBS.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and still with me are Tim Marshall and James Hoare. To some, the sight of an American president at a parade in India is nothing to get too excited about. But when Barack Obama touched down in India, he became the first US president to visit the country more than once. But while many were busy underlining the symbolism behind the president's appearance, the presence of Russian-made military hardware there was a reminder of the lingering practicalities behind America's visit. James, you know, there's a big tussle going on for friends these days. Everyone wants them. And India is being courted on all sides by, you know, the Russians, as it seems to be on-off rapprochement with China, and the Americans are certainly keen to woo them as well. Who do you think is likely to come out as the leading dance partner?
Good question. I'm not sure I know the answer. I'm not sure anybody knows the answer. The US-India relationship has changed dramatically since the US-China relationship started going different, shall we say, or wrong. The Americans, for a long time, saw India as left-wing, left-leaning, and turning to the Russians, the Indians would argue they had no choice. And they also, the Americans favoured Pakistan for many, many years for a variety of reasons, including relations with China. And all those things have changed. And India and the United States have gradually, over the last 15, 20 years or so, edged closer together. And, of course, some of the past remains. You're not going to get rid of the Russian jets because that's what the Indian Air Force flies. But the big breakthrough, to my mind, came in 2005 with the acceptance that India's nuclear program was going to go ahead and the willingness to supply nuclear components to India. And that was a major change and sent signals. You can say they're the right signals, the wrong signals, but they certainly sent major signals around the world about how much importance the United States now attaches to its links with India.
Tim, it is the kind of the moving away from Pakistan. You obviously the majority of troops coming out of Afghanistan. It's proved a very unreliable friend. There's kind of chaos there. It's certainly not a good business partner.
They simply don't need them as much anymore. I mean, everything James said, I agree with. But you build on that history of the Cold War, how things changed, 2005 being the definitive breakthrough moment. Now we can really do business. It still takes time. America still needed Pakistan because of Afghanistan. Now they're coming out, they need Pakistan less. You can get even closer to India. Hence, he's going to the military parade. Hence, you can get slightly closer. And the second part of the jigsaw, and it's a Pakistan, India, America, China jigsaw. The Russians obviously are players as well, but it's Pakistan, India, America, China. China's busy cozying up to Pakistan. They're building a massive, massive deep port down at Gwadar in the south of Pakistan. And they one day hope to be able to use it probably as a naval dock, but certainly to get energy supplies up through Pakistan and a land route up into China. Now, the Americans are looking at this with great interest, and the Indians are looking at this with great interest. And I think part of the military agreements that they came to yesterday, and they've renewed a 10-year military agreement between the two of them, it's going to be things like, can we use your ports? Can our Navy refuel here? And that is about both of them trying to check China. And I think that they're not exactly natural allies, America and India, but I think they're more natural allies than China and America are.
Well, certainly for the Indians, James, and just finally, that China, not a democracy, India, a democracy. And the most pressing issue is that they don't agree with almost any of their border, do they? There's so much of that, there's so many potential tensions there.
Well, the India border?
With the India-China border, you know, that when you look between India to China...
Yeah. I think the relationship between China and India, whatever slight improvement there is from time to time, it is really unlikely to lead to anything very much.
Here, thank goodness there's a wall between them.
Well, there were two wars, in effect.
No, a wall,
sorry.
Himalayas.
Yeah, but they each see themselves as major Asian powers. They're partly competing for that sort of ground. And I think that it's always been odd in a way that the United States could not exploit its relations or did not exploit its relations with its potential relations with India. As you say, a democracy and all the other things that go with it.
Well, we weren't going to have a look at Venezuela today, but I'm afraid that we spent too much time in Greece. Well, who doesn't these days? We're going to have to leave it there. But James Hoare and Tim Marshall, thank you very much for joining us here on Midori House.
Thank you.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo. London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Well, there's lots still to come on the second half of today's Midori House, including a visit to Beirut, where we visit a newly reopened museum. But before we get started on that, here's James Luckhurst.
Greek left-wing leader Alexis Tsipras has been sworn in as the prime minister of a new hardline anti-bailout government, determined to face down international lenders and end nearly 5 years of tough economic measures. Kurdish forces say they've driven Islamic State militants from Kobane, ending a four-month battle for the northern Syrian town. Fighters from the popular protection units were said to have entered outlying areas in the east of the town after the jihadists retreated. 10 people have been killed and another 13 injured after a Greek fighter plane crashed during NATO training in Spain today. A spokesman for the Defence Ministry said the F-16 plane crashed shortly after taking off at the training centre in Albacete. America's National Weather Service has warned a potentially historic blizzard could dump up to 90 centimetres of snow on the US northeast coast. New York's mayor said the storm could be the city's biggest ever. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, James. And you're back with Midori House. And the time here in London is 18:31, which means it's 21:31 in Moscow and 16:31 in Rio de Janeiro. I know where I'd rather be. Now, time checking with one of our correspondents, of course, around the world, as we always do at this time of the day. And we were chatting about the election result in Greece a little earlier. Let's revisit that now with our man in Athens, Chris Konstas. Chris, can you give us a little bit of an idea about how the business community has reacted to this news? We spoke to you last week and you said there was some deep concern amongst the business community that things could get very difficult for them if we saw this Syriza government come into power.
Well, there is no surprise that the business community has taken the conservative road in its estimations about a post of Syriza election victory in the Greek economy. You all know we need an agreement with the Troika. It is necessary for Greece to avoid a Cyprus-style bank shutdown. Greece requires an official sector funding to meet its obligations in 2015. It's something between 6 and 15 billion euros, depending on the economic assumptions. So, we are very worried that the European Central Bank will likely limit its exposure in the Greece's central bank. This implies that the ECB will no longer provide cash to the Greek banks to withstand firms' withdrawals or deposits. That means that the domestic economy would contract under cash withdrawal limitations. Export economy would also shrink, as letters of export credit by Greek banks would not be accepted in a global banking system. So business people are very worried. We need a deal with the Troika. Some people were quite happy when they heard yesterday Mr. Tsipras, the new prime minister. He said he made some moderate comments, noting that the new government will be ready to negotiate a fair solution with Europe. There will be no mutually destructive conflict with the partners. There will be no submission, and Syriza will negotiate based on its own reform plan. Now, we wait to see what this reform plan is.
But do you think, what's interesting today is, that actually, the global markets, as we were mentioning earlier, didn't seem that unsettled by the news. The euro fluctuated a little bit here and there. The share prices around the world went up a little bit and then down a little bit and up a little bit. But in the end, it didn't seem to have the reverberations that people were expecting. Do you think that actually there is a sense that that this could actually be okay for Greece?
Well, yes, it would be okay for Europe as well. Some people believe here that Tsipras' only concern is that he will do whatever it takes to make nice with Greece's foreign partners and lenders. He certainly doesn't have any solid assurances from key officials in Berlin, Washington, or Brussels. There will be some kind of deal on the table. It is quite sure. Now, we have to see what kind of deal this is. After all, this is a democracy. People have voted for now for the new government, and we expect this new government to take the responsibility that we are seeing. As a journalist, I'm forced now to monitor closely the negotiations for the formation of this coalition government. But I have to see the details on the key positions of the government as an indication as to new government's short and medium-term strategy.
And Chris, we were chatting kind of about the tiny details of the Prime Minister, the fact that he didn't wear a tie to be sworn in, the fact that he didn't have a priest to bless him either. As outsiders, these things seem to be a kind of a bit of a break with tradition. How did they play with Greek people, do you think?
Well, people who know Tsipras well say that he wants to push. He's a little bit of a rock star. He's a 40-year-old. He's the youngest prime minister Greece has. He's the first real left leader. He has received a rock star reception from the European left. He's investing heavily in this role, European leader role, I mean. And a lot of people predict that he won't be able to be long before the star and the hawks come to the longer heads. But still, what matters now to the people is that this austerity plan, this austerity policy, ends at some point. Greece has suffered a six-year recession. We've lost 30% of GDP. Every family has an unemployed person. Unemployment rate is up to 27%. Now, this is no time for jokes. This is no time for political maneuvering. We need solutions to the real economy. And that's the problem today.
Obviously, many people in Greece have had a really tough time of it. Incredible poverty, people losing their jobs, seeing their real salaries and pensions reduced. Do you feel that on the right in Greece, there's the people who have managed to kind of keep going and who've maybe had wealth that's overseas as well, have kind of brought this result on themselves a little bit by showing a little bit of lack of sympathy for the people who haven't done so well?
Well, no. On the contrary, we have managed to survive this terrifying period because of social solidarity. Greek families stick together. Family role is quite important here. And I would say that we have survived this. Imagine that this country has lost 30% of GDP in just 4 or 5 years. This is not something that has not happened, not even in the World War II time. So I would say that we need some restructure plans in the real economy. We need to change our economy. And, of course, we are used in a different style of living the years before. Now this has got to change. Until this changes, foreign investors, people from have the money abroad, will not bring them back to the country.
And finally, what can you tell us about the right-wing party that has joined in the coalition?
Well, that's the other question. The leftist anti-austerity party Syriza won the elections, but Mr. Tsipras met this morning with the leader of the right-wing anti-austerity party, the independent Greeks, Mr. Kamenos. He's a populist. There is some kind of balance. The main message here is that Greece needs to stop the austerity policies. I don't know if this can happen without a deal with the Troika, without a deal with the lenders. We have to see how this works out.
Well, Chris, thank you very much for joining us. That's Chris Constas there, who is, of course, in Greece. And you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Up next, we're off to Beirut.
Covering everything from Security Council shifts at the United Nations to smart startups in the Hudson Valley, Monocle's New York Bureau's beat can also extend all the way down to Argentina and up and over to Alaska. Ed Stocker is our Bureau Chief in New York.
From business to politics via the arts, we're tapped into what's happening in this fast-paced city across the US and travelling into Latin America.
With one of the biggest beats in our correspondent network, New York bureau chief Ed Stocker is just as likely to be reporting for Mexico City or Medellin as he is from Manhattan. You can hear his report across the schedule here on Monocle 24.
Every Sunday, the Bulletin with UBS goes behind the numbers and the hype to explain what's really happening in the world of finance. Brought to you from the desks of the key analysts at UBS and experts from around the world, the programme delivers definitive insights into the people, places and products set to shape the week ahead. This is the show that explains how a fast-moving financial world really works. Set your agenda for the week ahead. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every Sunday at 1800 hours Tokyo time, 1600 hours London time, 11 a.m. in New York. Anytime after that, you can download from monocle.com and via iTunes or SoundCloud. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. Now, after an eight-year period of artistic drought, Beirut's Sursok Museum is ready to roar back to life. Joining us now on the line from Beirut is Monocle's contributor there, freelance journalist Venetia Rainey. Venetia, thank you very much for joining us. Can you just explain to us a little bit, first of all, about what the Sursok Museum is and why it's been, well, not in use for a little while?
So, thanks for having me on the show. The Sursok Museum was one of its kind in Lebanon back in the 60s and 70s. It was a real treasure trove of contemporary and modern Lebanese art. But it just sort of, it had its first renovation in 1970 to 1974. And 1 year later, the Lebanese Civil War began and it just completely fell out of cultural relevance. It stopped being the sort of spark for debate and artistic passion that it used to be. And as you mentioned, it's been 8 years and a second renovation, so a long time the city's been waiting for this place to reopen.
And it's an old house, and then I understand that they've kind of, you know, extended it greatly to show more of the collection. What will be the initial show that will open the new museum?
So they're planning on doing an exhibition showing how Beirut has been represented from 1800 to 1960, which is a huge sweeping aim for an opening exhibition, and one that Beirut is pretty excited to see, actually. Beirut doesn't often get to reflect on itself going that far back. It's normally about the war and, you know, the Syrian civil war now.
And tell me, the Sursok family, who were they? Who were these people who built up this collection and owned the house?
They were a very wealthy merchant family that came about in the early 1900s, I think. And there's now a whole street dedicated to them in Beirut, Sursok Street, on which the museum is placed. And it's a series of incredibly beautiful Italianate-style palatial buildings. Quite a sight to behold. And the Sursok Museum itself is a bit like a wedding cake, actually. Huge and white and very ornate.
Venetia, it's been the last year has been a little bit tough for Beirut in many ways, where the civil war in Syria has seen a kind of drop off of the number of visitors coming to the city from the Gulf. We've seen also many people who are Lebanese but living in the diaspora not returning home over the summers and things. Is it difficult to get projects like this off the ground at the moment when there is so many question marks hanging around?
Well, yeah, I think the fact that it's taken 8 years for this museum to start to think about reopening is a massive indication of that. You know, when they first started doing renovations, they thought, great, we'll open in a few years. Then it was the 2006 war with Israel. Then in 2008, there were problems with Hezbollah. And now we have the Syrian civil war. So it's very difficult. It's hard to know what this year will bring, but I think that's finally on the home stretch.
And beyond the walls of the Sursok, how vibrant is the art scene currently in Beirut? I know you have many other, you know, modern art museums, you know, great galleries in places like Mar Mikkel, but how is the art scene there?
It's very vibrant. Like you said, it's very vibrant, but it's also quite fractured and tends to be quite obscure. It targets a certain part of society, if you like. And what this museum will do is hopefully link up the new sort of creative hipstery types who love art and the older generation who remember the golden era of Lebanese art. And what's really missing, actually, in Beirut is a museum culture. We only have one big museum, and frankly, hardly anyone goes to it. So I think part of the aim of the museum's new director is to try and restart that culture of going to museums.
Well, Venetia, thank you very much for joining us. That's Venetia Rainey, who's a journalist who's based in Beirut, telling us all about Beirut's new, or renewed, rather, Sursok Museum. And I think we're going to have some music now, actually. It's a slight pause. And we're going to hear a track from Kate Miller. This is from her debut EP, Neophyte. And this is Black Rivers. A little bit of angst for you. That was Kate Miller with the track Black Rivers, and that's from her debut EP, Neophyte. Now, you're listening to Rory House on Monocle 24, and the time is 18:48 here in London, and it's time now, well, you know what it's time for. It's time for our daily arts review, and joining us is Francesca Gavin, visual arts editor at Dazed and Confused. Francesca, I'd like to talk about a few of the exhibitions you've got here. We're going to start with Rashid Johnson, which is at Hauser & Wirth here in London. Tell us, for the uninitiated, who Rashid Johnson is.
Rashid's an incredible artist. He's based in Brooklyn, but he's originally from Chicago. He emerged originally coming out of photographic practice, very much looking at the representation of African Americans, and developed this into an incredible sculptural work. So you get these wild installations made of black tar and cocoa butter and plants and old Al Green record covers and defunct radios. And it's developed and developed into using spray cans and mirroring. And this is his first big solo show at the huge Hauser & Wirth on Savile Row.
Because is this a new space that they've got at Hauser & Wirth? Not so new?
Well, I think they've had it for about 4 years or
and something. And how many exhibitions, how many pieces have they got in there?
Well, I haven't, don't know as yet.
Yeah, it's just about to open,
it literally opens tomorrow night between 6 and 8 p.m.
Well, we can go and stick our nose up against the windows.
Oh, it's definitely worth seeing.
But these are would be described as installations or sculptures, or what's the...
I think there's definitely... he's going to be doing two kinds of new work. The exhibition's called Smile. Half of it is new bronzes that he's been working with. So very much continuing his interest in sort of wall relief sculptures, if that makes sense. They might have like elements coming off of them. And then the other half is drawing particularly on a very well-known Elliot Erwin, photograph of a black boy shooting himself in the head. And I think that very much draws on Rashid's own interest in photography and the representation of blackness. And I think it'll be very, very interesting seeing how he's kind of exploring that in a more abstract painting way.
Okay, next show up for us to look at is the Tino Segal, which is in Amsterdam. And again, you're looking excited about this
one. I'm very excited by this. This is one of those kind of exhibitions which keeps happening with the Stedelijk since it's reopened that you want to travel to. Beatrix Ruff, who's a very, very well-known European curator, who I think she was at the Secession in Vienna, she's just taken over the Stedelijk as director. Alison Goldstein, who was a previous one, has left. And Tino, who won the last big prize at the Venice Biennale, is doing a retrospective, but kind of a reworking of his performance works. And there's 12 throughout the year. It's basically a year-long exhibition. It's beginning with a small intervention in the permanent collection of the show. And then every single performance each month is going to grow and grow and become more and more participatory. Part of the thing I love about Tino is he actually doesn't do catalogues. He barely tells people the shows are on. If you see things, it's almost like it's all about the experiential moment, the idea of sort of stumbling across something or discovering something. For example, he had a collaborative piece as part of Philip Perrineau's show in the Palais de Tokyo in Paris, and you wouldn't know it was there. A little girl came up to you and started performing if you were lucky to wait to the end of a certain video piece. But it's always very disconcerting.
And where is Segal from? You didn't know.
I put you on the spot there.
How about that?
Shockingly, I don't remember. I know he's brunette, okay. If that's helpful.
That helps a lot.
He's best known within the UK for doing a very large performance within the Turbine Hall with a lot of volunteers. It's very much telling them about their lives and running around the spaces.
And what did he do here when he was at the Turbine Hall then?
It was basically, he got a lot of volunteers to come and they would kind of have a performative dance routine, if that makes sense.
So this is when you go to a moving museum and some strange person comes up to you.
Yeah,
it could be art. Don't push them away.
No, it's very, especially when it comes to Tino Segal. One of my personal favorites is the piece that he did at Documenta, which was a completely black room and you couldn't see anyone, but you could hear them around you. And if you waited for about half an hour, your eyes would get accustomed to the room you were in, and then you could see that there actually was a dance performance happening, but in pure blackness. But you wouldn't actually know until you waited and persevered and really stayed with the piece. And I thought that was incredible. So expecting those kind of works over a year and each one developing within an incredible gallery in Amsterdam.
And I guess what's interesting is, obviously very different kind of positions in the art world. But, since the revamping of the Rijksmuseum, Amsterdam feels like a more essential place to go these days.
The Rijksacademy is an incredible school. So there's a lot of respect for all of young artists emerging out of Amsterdam as a city. And there are very, it went for about 10 years with no museums. The Stedelijk and the Rijksmuseum were closed forever. So I think everyone's finally happy that shows are happening there again. However, the rest of Holland also has some great spaces. Eindhoven notably has the Van Abbe Museum and MU, which is an incredible museum attached to the Design Academy out there. So I think Holland's always had a very, very good reputation, but it's becoming more reputation of a place for artists to develop and grow in the early stages of their career.
Now, another show that's on at the moment, which has kind of popped up in a couple of other programmes as well, because I think this is one of those shows that people like to get their teeth into. This is a show that takes Kazimir Malevich's radical painting of the Black Square, first shown in Russia 100 years ago, and I think it almost caused riots in the streets. It was so disturbing, as the emblem of a new art and a new society. So 100 artists have been asked to kind of respond to it, haven't they?
Well, The Adventures of the Black Square at the Whitechapel, it's kind of the first floor is very much a survey of the history of abstraction and very much geometric extraction. And then the top floor is a sort of more late 20th century bringing together of more contemporary artists. What I found specifically interesting, if you see the show, is the number of older female artists that you probably never have heard of that you could discover through the show. Iwona Blaswick, the director of the Whitechapel, has done an incredible job of basically redefining the history of what abstraction is. Like, there's an artist called Bella Kolarova who made these amazing geometric works out of fasteners and buttons, like strange everyday objects, or an incredible early textile artist called Sophie Tauber Arp, who would kind of make tapestries, but they're, if you imagine Kandinsky or Malevich, but in sort of a fabric form, and an artist you would never have heard of otherwise. So I found that very interesting, the idea of basically feminizing the idea of geometric utopian abstraction, as opposed to it just being seen as something very linear and, Malevich, masculinity, and Russian constructivism, that kind of thing.
Tell me, obviously not with the Rishi Johnson exhibition, but what it seems to be, you seem to be describing with lots of these exhibitions is, for the gallery, they need to put on a bit of, in the real sense, put on a bit of a show as well. There needs to be entertainment that's beyond the wall and beyond the thing you're looking at. You're talking about being very immersed in these experiences and what happens there. Feel that that's much more of kind of what we now expect from our gallery
completely
visits?
I think the idea of seeing art has become much more experiential. It's become much more a form of entertainment. It's become much broader. It's not necessarily just one object on the wall. I think people get very bored by that. I think a lot of artists would be. And we're also living in a moment where we're seeing a huge rise of the curator as someone very important. In a lot of these shows, you'll see the curator is just as well known as the artist within it. And how we look at work is being redefined by these individuals thinking on how to look at something in a much more physical way. So even when you're looking at work, which would have perhaps originally been seen in a more traditional gallery context, I think it's makes it much more contemporary.
Why is that the rise of the curator then, do you think?
It's really interesting. I mean,
but what do you think is the spur behind it? Because we do want to see things in more complicated ways, that we're looking for editors and narrators to kind of bring these artists, together in a more interesting format, or?
Well, I mean, it goes hand in hand with the rise of things like the biennial and the art fair and the project. I think that the idea of making people, and also superstar curators like Hans-Ulrich Obrist, for example, where people know him as an individual as much as, probably even more than a lot of the artists that he's putting on. So I think that's almost like, it's very much like an editor of a magazine, arguably.
Do you think that
or an imprint of a publisher?
Do you think that means that the successful artist these days has to to kind of court the curator as well?
Yes, very, very much so. The curator, the collector, the public. It's quite difficult being an artist today.
I'm sure it is, but it sounds like quite a few glasses of wine are probably involved of an evening.
Yes.
Good. Well, Kate, thank you very much for coming in to see us. That is, of course, Kate, what am I on about? Francesca Gavin. I've jumped back and reintroduce the song. That's Francesca Gavin, who's the visual arts editor at Dazed and Confused. And that's all we have on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests at the top of the show, who are, of course, Tim Marshall. Today's show was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by David Pleasant. Alia and Stefano were also doing some research for us, and our studio manager was Chris Grimes. Next, after the headlines, it's Culture with Mr. Robert Bound. And then at 2200 hours, it's The Monocle Daily. The show will be back at the same time tomorrow at 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Midori House, from me, Andrew Tuck, it's just time to say goodbye.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.